According to the director of the Iowa Center for Immigrant Leadership and Integration, the number of Iowa families volunteering to sponsor refugees has dropped by 93% since September 11, 2001. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. While the Lieutenant Governor touts Iowa's reputation for welcoming refugees to the state, Senator Chuck Grassley's concerned that some of the migrants could be terrorists. This hour, we'll take a look at these claims and examine the reasons behind Iowa's decrease in refugee sponsorship. I'll also talk with Pensy Payne, who traveled to Iowa from Laos after the fall of Saigon. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. President Barack Obama has said that the United States will take about 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. A portion of these refugees will be relocated to Iowa, and government agencies and private organizations are preparing to host Syrian families. Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds has come out saying that Iowa's known for being welcoming to refugees. Yet, according to the director of the Iowa Center for Immigrant Leadership and Integration, who we had on a couple weeks ago, the number of Iowa families volunteering to sponsor refugees has dropped by 93% since September 11, 2001. So this hour, we're going to try and find out why less refugees are being sponsored in Iowa. We're also going to talk about what the transition process is like for a refugee. So joining me from the Des Moines studio, we have John Wilkin. He's the director of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services. Hi, John.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
And also with you in the studio, Rachel Kinker. She is with the Catholic Charities in Des Moines. She's a refugee resettlement program manager. We'll be talking to her in the second half. And also Pensy Payne. She's a representative of the Lao American Association of Iowa. She came to Iowa in 1979 as a refugee of the Vietnam War. Hi, Pensy.
Hello.
Hi, thank you. So, you know, John, just to start us off, so we have President Obama saying we'll take in roughly 10,000 Syrian refugees. How many refugees can we expect to take in here in Iowa?
It's very difficult to put any concrete numbers to it, and the reason I'm saying that is it will go through the normal process, which is when Syrian refugees start to be processed, they will be allocated to the 9 national resettlement agencies. Those agencies then will make a determination on where they will place them across the United States and what are called their affiliate offices. If I had to guess, I would anticipate that it would be less than 200, maybe less than 100. But that will be a part of a consultation process where the national offices will reach out to their affiliates like Rachel's office, and they will collectively make a determination of how many refugees they think their office or agency can handle. The other thing that makes it a little difficult to forecast is I'm making an assumption that most of the people coming are going to be what we call free cases. They don't have relatives living in the United States, so they're not going to be predestined to go to Iowa, for example. So the national offices have a little bit more latitude about how they're going to distribute the caseload. And the other thing is hard to predict how soon refugees will begin to come.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly does taking in refugees mean? Because, you know, refugees aren't going to come with, you know, a bank account ready and the knowledge ready to just, you know, get an apartment and be settled. It involves possibly host families and sponsor families. What exactly is that process like?
Well, I'm going to answer a little bit, but then you might want to ask Rachel, since her agency is one of the two that does the actual resettlement of refugees. The Department of State has a contract with the 9 agencies, and they have very specific details of the services that have to be provided in the first 90 days that refugees come to the United States. And that's the same all across the country. So there are a set of what we call core services, very simply meeting the family at the airport, securing housing for them, helping them obtain Social Security cards, providing basic food and clothing and household items for them, enrolling their children in school, setting up appointments for all of them to have a health screening, helping adults who are able to work to register and get engaged in employment activities. So those are what are called the basic core services, orientation, basic orientation. There are other things that Rachel might want to talk about that they provide. In the old days, back from 75 when the program started in Iowa, up through probably 97 or 98, most refugees coming into Iowa, as you mentioned, had sponsors. They could be a church, they could be a group of private individuals, they could be an individual, they could be relatives of the families who were coming. That is not the prevalent dominant model any longer for a variety of reasons. So in general, these days, there are not sponsors that are being recruited to host the families. But if they have relatives, and in the case of the refugees coming into Iowa through the resettlement program, 99% of them are coming here because they have relatives. So while they're not formally responsible, they certainly step up and provide a lot of assistance to the refugees coming.
Mm-hmm. And we will get into more of the process of how this happens here in a little bit. But first, I want to hear from sponsors of families in the past. Or if you are a refugee living in Iowa, tell us about your experience. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Again, that number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, visit our Facebook page, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And let's go to Pensy Payne. Pensy, you came to Iowa, as I said, at the beginning in 1979 as a refugee of the Vietnam War. You left Laos after the war at 11 years old and came here from a refugee camp in Thailand. Take us back a little bit. What caused you and your family to relocate?
The reason I came to Iowa is because of my dad. He left the country first because of war, and he left to Thailand. A year later, he sent for us. He got a sponsor, but he didn't want to come to the United States without his family. So he sent for us. So our uncle helped us escape from Laos to the Mekong River, and we stationed in the camp almost a year before we got sponsorship from Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And what was living in that camp like? Can you give us an idea?
Oh, yes. It's really crowded, dirty, and the food is not really standing food, so we have to provide for ourselves or from like the Red Cross or from help from different agencies. But mostly it's we are really crammed in housing. We live in like little bungalow. But for us, it was seven members of the family living in one room, and all the foods are portioned by the director of the camp, I guess we call him. We will get once a week a portion for the family, and we have to, just deal with that for a week or a month until another shipment of food comes again.
So you were in the camp, you were waiting to come to Iowa, but I believe back then you had to wait for a family in Iowa to sponsor you to come here. Is that right?
Yes. Our family is so big. We have seven members, and it's hard to get sponsorship because if we get a family sponsorship, they only want like four members, a parents, two kids, but we have five kids and a parent, so there was seven members in our family, and it's hard to get a sponsorship. Usually a big family like us will get sponsored by a church because they can handle the number. But we got a sponsorship from Iowa through Des Moines Register Reporter, and Rajuman was one of the reporters during that time, and he sponsored us. I didn't think they expect seven members to show up at the airport. they expect like four members, but we show up seven, and they said, okay, we'll take you. So, but they're all single reporter. I think we stay connected with Rajuman because he was here in Iowa. So we become friends with his family, and he showed us the rope, you know, to become an Iron, help us with housing, help my parents with job, enroll us in school, and he just adopted us like he was our second parent beside our parents.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, when you say, you know, they helped you out, what kinds of things did they help you with? Because this must have been, you know, kind of a culture shock for you and for them.
Yes, it was. Because when I came in 1979, was in December, it's really cold. And we were all in short and T-shirt and sandals. Ugh. And back then, the Des Moines airport, we had to walk in from the plane to the hub. So they opened the door, and there was snow on the ground. They all pushed us out, like, you know, you have to walk through the snow, through the hub. And we said, no way, it's snow. So everyone's like, let's go back. We don't want to come to Iowa. But but we came out anyway, and then there was people greeting us with coats and, you know, family member. We saw familiar faces, like our uncle that was here in Iowa, and our sponsor. It was a whole bunch of people. So we feel like welcome. And then our first night at our sponsor's house, they have like a wood stove. You know, it's really cold. And we was still in the cold. We refused to take off a coat. It was so cold. So we refused to sleep in the room. So we all sleep in the living room together, bundled up in our coat still. And Rajiman thought we were strange, you know. Why are we still in cold? He said, it's so hot in here. We're sweating. We said, no, it's cold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. What do you think things would have been like if you didn't have a sponsor family, if you just came here completely on your own?
We probably been really lost, and we probably been really depressed, because the only word that we know is like, hello, my name is, you know, can you help me? That's the basic language. We didn't know anything. And I was 11 years old. I was only fourth grade. And when I started school, they gave me Ryan Rainbow book. It's like a fourth grade book. I said, no, I want to learn the ABC first. Mm-hmm. They said, no, that's preschool. Then they said, but for me, I had to catch up a lot, like 4 years of school for the for me and my brother. We had to like jump right into like fourth grade or whatever grade they put us, and we had to learn quick, because that's only a way we can survive or pass school, is to learn quick the language. But as for my parents, they have to get a job. They have to find an apartment right away, because I think the service was giving us help for a few months, 3 months maybe, to give us like cash or for rent an apartment. And Rajiman was help us find a job as a sponsor. So my parents got a job right away within a month. They got into an apartment. And my parents have no time to learn the language, so they just learn it at work. They have to assimilate real fast to the culture and learn the language real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, too, we have to learn the language or we won't make it in school. So our parents always pushing us, you know, you're on your own. We cannot help you in school. You have to help yourself, just like we helping ourselves to work. And our job is to provide you food and housing. So your job is to learn and learn the language quick.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, depression. I believe you mentioned that if you had not had a sponsorship.
Yes.
Sponsorship. And mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, John, you're the director of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services. How common is depression? I mean, people are coming from a war zone and they get thrown into a foreign place where everything's just really hard. You're kind of taking a few steps back in the learning process. How common is depression in these communities?
Well, I think we'd want to distinguish between what we would call clinical depression and what I would call kind of an anticipated depression. Being a refugee is very traumatic. People who are refugees are not leaving their country by choice. In addition to that, many refugees' families experience coming and leaving other family members behind, or they were sent to other parts of the world and they may never see each other again. There's a loss of esteem, their position in society. There's a loss of – most of the refugees come from parts of the world where extended families are very communal, and so the natural support systems that they have are lost. And a lot of refugees early on – the adults especially suffer from role reversals because the children adapt more quickly. They learn the language, and the adults struggle more with that. So the resettlement experience itself, most of us would have a tendency to have some feelings of depression because of all the things that have happened to us. I think almost universally, refugees' first response is gratitude. They have escaped from a very harsh environment. But once they have to start dealing with the realities of being here, I think that you would find that many refugees would say it's difficult. And some groups of refugees have more difficulty because they may have not had as much exposure to Western culture. They may not had education in their home countries. They may have languished in refugee camps for a long time. And unfortunately, a lot of refugees have suffered severe traumatizing experiences both in their home country and in their refugee camps. So I would say that a lot of refugees struggle with sadness and some feelings during courses of their resettlement, but most of them are able to move through that and process things so that they don't become stuck. But that's not to say there aren't some people for whom their feelings of sadness overwhelm them, and that certainly does happen for some clients.
Mm. And as Pensy mentioned that, you know, she and her family had to wait for a sponsor in Iowa to come here, but we've moved as a state away from that sponsorship model. Why have we done so? It sounds like it was really helpful.
Well, first I need to clarify something. Every refugee who comes is assigned to an agency. The agency has the choice of whether or not they go out and recruit a sponsor or whether they, as an agency, resettle the refugees through their paid staff. So it's true that if an agency said, we're not going to bring a family like Pensy's without having a local sponsor, then you are waiting for it. But they always had the ability, if they chose to take that case, even if there wasn't a sponsor. I think there's a number of reasons why the model has shifted. First of all, in the very beginning of the resettlement program in Iowa, it was a statewide program. When the Thai Dom first started coming, there are pictures of the airplanes landing and the families being taken out to Camp Dodge and all being assigned out to their sponsors across the state. One of the things that started happening early into the program was refugees did not like being so isolated and scattered, and so many refugees began to migrate to certain communities where they could get jobs or there were other people living there. This wasn't just an Iowa trend. This was a national trend that it became apparent that, in general, it wasn't good to isolate refugee families in proximity from other refugees of their ethnic group. The second thing that happened is that over time, due to changes in resources for refugee resettlement, the refugee offices across the state began to close, so that by 2005, the only resettlement offices in Iowa were in Polk County, and there were a couple of years where 100% of the refugees arriving were resettled in Polk County. I'm sharing that because I still get calls, even now, from communities who would like to help resettle refugees, but they don't live in the areas where refugee resettlement is taking place. So that was one factor. A second mm-hmm. factor was that the whole area of volunteerism went through a change in the 90s, which is you had less and less one-income earning families, which meant you had less volunteers. Volunteers in general, not just with the refugee program, they were looking for short-term commitments. They wanted to come in, do something quickly, and move on. And so the retirees became much more mobile and more active. So the volunteer pool changed. And then another factor was, again, as the dollars that supported the refugee program diminished, agencies who did resettlement were not able to sustain what we would call a volunteer recruiter or a sponsor recruiter. And so that made it more difficult for them to recruit. And then the last factor was, as the Vietnam program started to end, the number of refugees being admitted to the U.S. began to decline significantly, and it became increasingly difficult to recruit sponsors because you couldn't tell them when a family was going to come. And so interest kind of waned a little bit, and volunteers found other things to do, so that when the program rebooted, so to speak, in the mid-90s with the Bosnian program, we were kind of building volunteer all over again, and we had a very vigorous response, but the Bosnians were coming so quickly that we could not meet all of the demand for sponsors, and so families started to help more, and eventually the model moved more and more to families helping and to paid staff helping. If you would ask me, were there terrific benefits from having sponsors? Yes, there were. But it's not a model that's sustainable in lots of areas within Iowa now, simply because we've retracted where refugee resettlement is taking place. And also, there's been a shift in how volunteers are engaged by the resettlement offices. There's still a large number of people interested in helping refugees, but it might be short term. I'll help teach English. I'll help take somebody to the doctor. I'll help set up an apartment. It's more function specific rather than becoming a partner like Roger Munn was with the family. So,
sure. Sort of being on – compared to being on call, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And so but that I don't want to leave the impression that all of a sudden Iowans got disengaged. It's just that the engagement is different than it was before. And I can tell you, and Pensy can talk about this more, every refugee who makes a connection with an American who somehow builds a bridge for them or helps, that is very beneficial. Now it could be happening with your ESL teacher. It could be happening with a regular classroom teacher. It's a church. There are still volunteers who step forward. There are agencies that are made up of refugees themselves, either through churches or through affiliations they have that reach out and help. So it would not be a good picture to say that Iowa is not still actively engaged. It's just a different kind of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Pensy, you've lived most of your life in the U.S. now. Do you still seek the advice of your sponsor?
No, we became friends with him. I guess we're still seeking advice because he's like my second parent. And, I mean, we go through a lot of stuff together. You know, a 35-year relationship is a long time for a sponsor. But we became part of his family. He became part of us, you know, his kid's birthday or kid's birthday, weddings, you know, my brother's wedding. I mean, every time we have something, we're always thinking of him. And we're always grateful for him for sponsoring us. Because without him, we would be here and we would have, like, adapt to Iowa so quickly. And he was very helpful. When he was single, then he got married, and we'd be part of his family too, and we'd be part of his kids' family, and he became a part of our family.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about how welcoming Iowa is to refugees this hour. The president has proposed to take in about 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. So we're seeing how welcoming Iowa is to those refugees. With me is Pensy Payne. She came to Iowa in 1979 as a refugee of the Vietnam War. Also, John Wilkin, he's the director of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services. I'm Emily Woodbury. We'll be back in just a moment. This is River to River. Good afternoon. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. President Obama has said that the United States will take in roughly 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. And usually Iowa takes about 1% of the refugees taken in by the United States. So this hour, we're asking the question, how friendly is the state of Iowa to incoming refugees? With me this hour, Pensy Payne. She's a representative of the Lao American Association of Iowa. She came to Iowa in 1979 as a refugee of the Vietnam War. John Wilkin, he's the director of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services. And joining us for the rest of the hour, Rachel Kinker. She's a refugee resettlement program manager at Catholic Charities in Des Moines. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
So I want to talk a little bit about, we've been comparing, you know, how Iowa has handled an influx of refugees in the past versus now. And, you know, John, you listed some of the reasons that, you know, refugee sponsorship has decreased in Iowa since 9/11/2001. You know, one of the things that we didn't really get to is, you know, government or Governor Robert Ray's part in bringing people here and settling them here in Iowa. He was very active in encouraging Iowans to take part in sponsoring refugees. Here's actually a clip from him when he was speaking to Iowa Public Television as part of a documentary about Iowa's Department of Refugee Services. Former Governor Robert Ray, he spoke glowingly of how Iowans responded to the Tidom refugees that were being brought to the state.
I was so proud of my state. People just welcomed these people that were who were going to lose their lives if they didn't find a home. It was a tragic situation, and Iowans just stepped forward and they opened their arms and their hearts, and they said, "We want to help." And I don't. Over the years, I don't know how many people have told me it was the greatest experience of their lives, their family. Would have the opportunity to help other people. And there's great satisfaction in that. And I've used this as an example where if you help others for the right reason, you'll be richly rewarded.
So, John, do you think volunteerism has declined in part because there isn't someone who's as vocal as Governor Ray was?
I don't really think that's the key factor. As I mentioned before, when Governor Ray was a pioneer. The refugee program as it exists now was not even legislatively in place at that time. It was really formalized in 1980 and 1982. However, I have to say that Governor Ray was a true humanitarian. And as you may know, he and his wife made several visits to refugee camps, and he definitely took a very personal interest in was actually quite a leader on the national scene, as was Senator Grassley, who also participated in the legislation that developed into the Refugee Act. I believe, and I think Rachel would kind of concur with this, that the will of Iowans is still there to be of service. It's simply a factor of how the whole enterprise works these days, and so I think that Iowans would still be responsive like they were then, and I think if that were the model that we wanted to use, people would definitely step up to the plate.
Mm-hmm. What role do you think Governor Branstad is taking in refugee resettlement efforts?
I think that the administration has continued the legacy from Governor Ray in terms of believing that Iowa has benefited from having refugees. And I think that they are supportive of what I want to call planned resettlement, meaning the standard resettlement program, which is what Rachel is involved with and what the Department of State manages. I think they share in the current situation the same concerns as some in Congress have, which is wanting to make sure that there's a careful screening process of refugees who are coming. And I think they do have a concern that it be a thoughtful resettlement process and that there be adequate consultation. And those things, I think, are in fact happening at the national level. Mm-hmm. But I think, as Lieutenant Governor suggested, Iowans still have big hearts and still are supportive. And I can tell you from our national partners at the national level, people think Iowa is a good place to be resettled. If you talk to Rachel's national office, or I talk to the national offices at other places, that's partly because of our economy, but it's also because of safety. It's our education. It's the supportive systems that we have in place. And so Iowa has a very strong reputation at the national level for being a good place for refugees.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rachel, yeah, go ahead. Tell us, you know, what is the role of private charities in refugee resettlement? What does Catholic Charities in Des Moines do for refugees?
Well, we work with two federal grants, and we basically provide a lot of those core services that John was talking about earlier. That ranges from greeting families at the airport to providing Social Security cards, assistance with obtaining Social Security cards, school enrollment, employment services, transportation, initial health appointments, and ESL classes, along with several other services.
Mm-hmm. Now, Penn State talked about this a little bit in the first half, but what all needs to be done to help refugees reach self-sufficiency? Because, you know, you can have all the right cards and documentation, but there's a huge culture shift here.
Yes. So we start with ESL classes. We also provide cultural orientation for all of our clients. And then it's basically a process of connecting our clients with the right services and referrals so that they can attain self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm. And you work with agencies and your organization itself helps place refugees. What do we know about the refugees coming to Iowa? Are there specific placements for the people coming to Iowa? Let's say, you know, certain qualifications?
Are you asking about employment qualifications?
Yeah. I mean, you know, are there certain types of refugees that are coming to Iowa specifically rather than going somewhere else?
Well, as John had mentioned earlier, they are primarily coming here because they have a friend or a family member that's living here already.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What have you heard about the Syrian refugees so far that may be coming to Iowa?
The information that I've received so far has been pretty much the same as what John's heard at this point.
Okay. Can you tell us, you know, what's different between this crisis and the crisis involving the Thai Dom refugees?
Well, I think John might be able to answer this a little bit better, having had a little bit more history and experience with
this topic.
Well, the Thai Dom were a unique story that will probably never be repeated again in history. And by that, I mean the Thai Dom people sent letters to, I think, 37 governors asking that they be resettled together as a community in one state. And Governor Ray said yes to that. I don't know if this is still true, but for a long time, outside of Laos, the United States had the largest number of Thai Dom living in a country. So it was a very unique opportunity right at the very beginning of the resettlement program. For many people who came in the early days of the Thai Dom program, fortunately for them, they did not languish in refugee camps for an extended period of time. Now, as the program evolved, that wasn't necessarily true. But the pivotal difference, I think, today that's going on, I think there's two things. One is the Syrian population, if we're talking about them, are scattered in many locations, where the Thai Dom populations, when they left, primarily had two major locations that they were going to, Malaysia and Thailand. But the added thing for all refugees now is 9/11. The fear of terrorism and appropriately processing people has made an impact on the refugee program. It's added another layer to the processing about which I have no familiarity, because it's the Department of Homeland Security, and if you're not connected to that process, you're not privy to all the decision making. Mm-hmm. All I can tell you is refugees are probably one of the most vetted groups of foreign born coming into the United States. And they always had clearances going on, but after 9/11, they became much more stringent. I'm mentioning this because it's very likely that that's going to make the processing of Syrians much slower than it would have been in 1975 when we were bringing refugees over. In another way, there's quite a bit of similarity, I think, of what I know about Syrian refugees to this date and the Thai Dom, in that many of the Syrians are educated, middle class. They probably have some familiarity with Western life, and that was true for a lot of the Thai Dom and Vietnamese when they were first coming, because we were getting the professionals and the highly educated. So there are probably more similarities in that regard. The other difference is that in the old days, almost all refugees that fled went to a refugee camp. With the Syrian refugees, they are scattered all over. A lot of them are struggling just to find a place to exist. As you've seen from the news, some of them are just basically living in the fields, which the Thai Dom did in the very beginning. But there are not nearly the structured refugee camps, not just for Syrians, but for a lot of people who are on the move today. And so there's a whole lot more uncertainty, and I'm guessing more challenges for them to get registered for refugee programs and to get through the interview processes, because there is not like five large refugee camps where all of these people are fleeing to. And so that's a huge difference as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about refugees coming to Iowa this hour. If you yourself are a refugee, or if you've sponsored a refugee here in the state, please join our conversation, share your thoughts. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Give us a call again, 866-780-9100, or you can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And John, you brought up a point about, you know, a lot of the migrants being Muslim. And I think it's very interesting when we talk about, you know, the processing, it's going to take longer. You know, we heard earlier last week from Senator Chuck Grassley, who, you know, said this raises security concerns. We actually have a clip of some of his concerns.
My main concern is if we take from the Middle East, and it's not just Syria, it would be other countries in the Middle East, that we're going to be very careful who we take that doesn't have any contact with ISIS, and hopefully abandoning the area because of the turmoil that's going on and a dislike for ISIS. But we know that ISIS has very clearly said that they want to sneak people into Europe and America under the refugee, and those people would be coming here to cause damage. So what are we doing to make sure that doesn't happen?
So, John, I wonder, you know, we talked about, you know, the cultural shift being hard regardless, but with this fear of terrorism, does that just, you know, exemplify the problem? Do you think there will be kind of a cultural gap because of that?
My experience has been, regardless of a person's ethnicity or religion, they have been successful in adapting to life in Iowa. I think that Senator Grassley articulates what some people have as concerns for the program, and there I'm not knowledgeable enough to answer how Homeland Security is addressing that, other than to say I know that refugees go through multiple security clearance checks. We currently have a fair number of Muslims who have been resettled in Iowa with no significant issues related to that, and I want people to be clear about this. It's not just Middle East. We have a number of Bosnian Muslims who are coming. There are some Southeast Asian Muslims who are now being considered for resettlement because they are minorities. I in general terms, have not seen difficulties in us getting volunteers to work with the refugee populations we have coming, and fortunately, from my point of view, with the state of Iowa, I have not run into significant prejudice and pushback because there are refugees coming who happen to be Muslims. I think my experience has been it has more to do with what's the world situation that's pushing those people out, and Iowans in general have stepped up to the plate and been very, very supportive. I'm not minimizing the concerns people have. It's just not an area that I'm really not conversant with what all the security balances will go, other than I know that's something we're hearing from many places.
Rachel, we don't know whether or how many Syrian refugees we'll get here in Iowa, but is your organization working to get ready for this potential influx of refugees?
At this point, since we don't really know what kind of population size we'll be seeing, we currently have staff that would be able to interpret, and we can kind of assume what the normal process would be, but we're as prepared as we can be at this point.
Mm-hmm. We had a caller ask earlier this hour, they couldn't stay on the line, but what types of qualifications he needed to volunteer with refugees? If, you know, someone's listening and they want to become involved, what can they do?
They can just get in touch with us at our agency. We have a variety of different opportunities, and that can be something that if someone's able to volunteer once a week or less frequently, we always need assistance with bus training, ESL classes, a variety of different tasks.
Mm-hmm. John, you know, as far as government involvement, as far as public involvement goes, do we have enough funding in all the right areas to prepare for this?
Are you talking about at the national level?
Well, we could say both the national and state level. How are we doing?
If we're talking about this extra $10,000, the process is that the president makes a recommendation to Congress on all the numbers of refugees to be admitted each year. Congress then has to approve the number and allocate the funds. I have not heard or seen anything that would indicate that there would be additional funding beyond the normal amount of money that's allocated for each refugee in the resettlement program. So I'm not anticipating that there would be additional funding other than just the normal per capita. If you ask almost any person who's in my position across all the other states, or you ask any resettlement agency, they would say, no, the funding is not sufficient. And many states would say that over the years, the federal government has shifted the costs down to the states and would suggest that there needs to be more funding coming from the federal level. One could say people will never say there's enough funding. But I think the reality is additional funding would be beneficial. But on the same token, I think that we're all trying to do the best with the resources we have and make good decisions with the resources we have.
And you're in contact with several resettlement agencies. What are you hearing from them? Are they getting prepared?
They're hearing pretty much what – there's going to be a conference call next Monday with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is the domestic site under Health and Human Services for the refugee resettlement, and the Department of State, and they're going to be giving the states, people in my positions, a briefing about what's going on and what the intended plans are. Again, it will be happening at the national level with the voluntary resettlement agencies, the nine of them. I'm not anticipating things that will be out of the norm because there's a consultative process that goes on every year between the agencies and their affiliates and the state refugee coordinators about placement of refugees. So I think the kinds of things we're going to probably hear is, when do they expect people to start coming? Where will they come from? Are they looking at what we call cluster sites? Do they want to put X number of families in particular areas? So they're going to be asking agencies to come up with sites that they think would lend themselves to that. That's the kind of discussion that I would anticipate. If Congress gets its work done, the approval of the recommendations should happen before October 1. Typically, you have to have the allocations made before October 1. If they don't, then that will also put a hold on refugee arrivals, not just Syrians, because you have to have that authorization.
We have about a minute left. Before we go, Pensy Payne, I'd like to ask you, you've been living in Des Moines for many years, but you are a refugee yourself. And I wonder, when you're watching the news from abroad, listening to the national conversation on refugees and migrants, what do you think isn't being discussed right now that should be?
You got to realize that when you said refugees, usually people from suffer from either war or something that forced them out of their country. And the main priority is that it's the safety of their family, and they just want to go somewhere that's safe for them and their family and start over. They're not worrying about politics or anything else. They just want to take their family to safety, you know, live somewhere that is safe for them. And, you know, whatever religion they practice, you know, it's, you know, because everybody wants to come to America because they know it's a land of freedom. And we are the melting pot, you know, we have so many refugees and immigration that started the country. Southeast Asian, you know, had a war, Vietnam War, fought Vietnam War. We came here hoping to start a new life and start a family here. And the same thing in European, you know, they just want to come here, bring their family here for safety and start again. And they just need the opportunity, you know, and of course, right now, because of 9/11, everybody fear of terrorism, but you have to consider other stuff, too, that people that come.
Pency Payne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay.
Pency Payne is a representative of the Lao American Association of Iowa. Also, John Wilkin, director of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services, and Rachel Kinker, Refugee Resettlement Program Manager at Catholic Charities in Des Moines. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. Thank you for joining us.